The Marching Season, Disc 5.
18. County Armagh, Northern Ireland. Michael came awake suddenly. He had no idea how long he had been unconscious. They had moved him into the trunk of the car. He opened his eyes but saw nothing but blackness. They had placed a sack of black cloth over his head. He closed his eyes again and took stock of his injuries. The men who had assaulted him were not the kind of professionals who could beat a man half to death without leaving a mark. Michael's face felt bruised and swollen, and he could taste dried blood around his mouth. He couldn't breathe through his nose, and his skull hurt in a dozen different places. Several ribs were broken, so even a shallow breath caused excruciating pain. His abdomen ached, and his groin was swollen. Because of the hood, the rest of Michael's senses were suddenly alive. He could hear everything taking place in the car, the groan of springs in the seats, the music on the car radio, the hard edges of spoken Gaelic. They could have been talking about the weather or where they planned to dump his body, and Michael wouldn't have known the difference. For several minutes, the car traveled at speed over a smooth road. Michael knew it was raining because he could feel the hiss of wet asphalt beneath him. After a while, 20 minutes, Michael guessed, the car made a 90-degree turn. Their speed decreased, and the surface of the road deteriorated. The terrain turned hilly. Every pothole, every bend in the road, every incline sent waves of pain from his scalp to his groin. Michael tried to think about something, anything besides the pain. He thought about Elizabeth, about home. It would be early evening in New York. She was probably giving the children one last bottle before bed. For an instant he felt like a complete idiot that he had traded an idyllic life with Elizabeth for a kidnapping and beating in Northern Ireland. But it was defeatist, so he drove it from his mind. For the first time in many years, Michael thought of his mother. He supposed it was because at least part of him suspected he might not make it out of Northern Ireland alive. His memories of her were more like those of an old lover than of a mother. Afternoons in Roman cafes, strolls along Mediterranean beaches, dinners in Grecian tavernas, a moonlight pilgrimage to the Acropolis. Sometimes his father would be gone for weeks at a time with no word. When he did come home, he could say nothing of his work or where he had been. She punished him by speaking only Italian, a language that bewildered him. She also punished him by bringing strange men to her bed, a fact she never hid from Michael. She used to tease Michael that his real father was a rich Sicilian landowner, which accounted for Michael's olive skin, nearly black hair, and long, narrow nose. Michael was never certain whether she was joking. The shared secret of her adultery created a mystical bond between them. She died of breast cancer when Michael was 18. Michael's father knew his wife and son had kept secrets from him. The old deceiver had been deceived. For a year after Alexandra's death, Michael and his father barely spoke. Michael wondered what had happened to Kevin Maguire. The penalty for betraying the IRA was swift and harsh, severe torture and a bullet in the back of the head. Then he thought, did Maguire betray the IRA, or did he betray me? He replayed the events of the evening. The two cars from the Europa, the red Escort and the blue Vauxhall. The two rendezvous sites Maguire had missed, the embankment on the River Loggan and the Botanic Gardens. He thought about Maguire himself, the chain-smoking, the sweating, the long journey down old roads. Had Maguire been jittery because he feared he was being watched? Or was he feeling guilty because he was setting up his old case officer? They turned from the roadway onto an unpaved, pitted track. The car bounced and rocked from side to side. Michael groaned involuntarily when a burst of pain from his broken ribs tore through his side like a knife point. "Don't worry, Mr. Osborne," a voice called out from inside the car. "We'll be there in a few minutes." 5 minutes later, the car drew to a stop. The trunk opened, and Michael felt a gust of wet wind. Two of the men took hold of his arms and pulled him out. Suddenly he was standing upright. He could feel the rain hammering on his head wounds, despite the hood. He tried to take a step, but his knees buckled. His captors caught him before he hit the ground. Michael draped one arm around each of them, and they carried him into a stone cottage. They passed through a series of rooms and doorways, Michael's feet dragging along the floorboards. A moment later, he was placed in a hard, straight-backed chair. "When you hear the door close, Mr. Osborne, you may remove the hood. There's warm water and a washcloth. Clean yourself up. You have a visitor." Michael removed the hood. It was stiff with dried blood. He squinted in the harsh light. The room was bare except for a table and two chairs. The peeling floral wallpaper reminded him of the guest cottage at Cannon Point. On the table was a white enamel basin filled with water. Next to the basin was a cloth and a small shaving mirror. There was a peephole in the door so they could watch him. Michael inspected his face in the mirror. His eyes were bruised and nearly swollen shut. There was a deep cut in the soft tissue above his left eye that needed stitches. His lips were puffy and split, and there was a large abrasion across his right cheek. His hair was matted with blood. There was a reason they had given him a mirror. The IRA had studied the art of interrogation well. They wanted him to feel weak, inferior, and ugly. The British and the RUC Special Branch had used those same techniques on the IRA for 3 decades. Michael carefully removed his coat and pulled up the sleeves of his sweater. He soaked the cloth in the warm water and went to work on his face, gently wiping away blood from his eyes, his mouth, and his nose. He leaned his head over the basin and washed the blood from his hair. He carefully ran a comb through his hair and looked at the mirror again. His features were still hideously distorted, but he had managed to remove most of the blood. A fist hammered on the door. "Put the hood back on," the voice said. Michael remained still. "I said put the fucking hood on." "It's covered with blood," Michael said. "I want a clean one." He heard footsteps outside the door and angry shouts in Gaelic. A few seconds later, the door burst open and a man wearing a balaclava strode into the room. He grabbed the bloody hood and pulled it roughly over Michael's head. "The next time I tell you to put the hood on, you put the fucking thing on," he said. "You understand me?" Michael said nothing. The door closed and he was alone again. They had imposed their will on him, but he had won a small victory. They left him sitting that way, wearing a hood that stank of his own blood for 20 minutes. He could hear voices in the house, and somewhere, a long way off, he thought he heard a scream. Finally, he heard the door open and close again. A man had entered the room. Michael could hear him breathing, and he could smell him. Cigarettes, hair tonic, a breath of a woman's cologne that reminded him of Sarah. The man settled into the remaining chair. He must have been a large man, because the chair crackled beneath his weight. "You can remove the hood now, Mr. Osborne." The voice was confident and naturally rich in timbre, a leader's voice. Michael removed the hood, placed it on the table, and looked directly into the eyes of the person seated across the table. He was a man of blunt edges, a broad, flat forehead, heavy cheekbones, the flattened nose of a pugilist. The cleft in his square chin looked as though it had been chipped away with a hatchet. He wore a white dress shirt and tie, charcoal gray trousers, and a matching waistcoat. The bright blue eyes burned with light and intelligence. For some reason, he was smiling. Michael recognized the face from Cynthia Martin's files at headquarters, a prison photograph from the maze, where the man had spent several years in the '80s. "Jesus Christ! I told my men to give you a wee hiding, but it looks as though they gave you a real pasting instead. Sorry, but sometimes the lads get a little carried away." Michael said nothing. "Your name is Michael Osborne, and you work for the Central Intelligence Agency in Langley, Virginia. Several years ago, you recruited an agent inside the Irish Republican Army named Kevin McGuire. You ran McGuire in a joint operation with MI5. When you returned to Virginia, you handed McGuire to another case officer, a man named Buchanan. Don't bother to deny any of this, Mr. Osborne. We don't have the time, and I mean you no harm." Michael said nothing. The man was right. He could deny everything, say it was all a mistake, but it would only prolong his captivity, and it might lead to another beating. "Do you know who I am, Mr. Osborne?" Michael nodded. "Humor me," he said, lighting two cigarettes, keeping one for himself and handing one to Michael. After a moment, a pall of smoke hung between them. Your name is Seamus Devlin. Do you know what I do? You're the head of IRA intelligence. There was a sharp knock at the door and a few murmured words in Gaelic. Devlin said, turn around and face the wall. The door opened, and Michael heard someone enter the room and place an object on the table. The door closed again. You can turn around now, Devlin said. The object that had been laid on the table was a tray with a pot of tea, two chipped enamel mugs, and a small pitcher of milk. Devlin poured tea for both of them. I hope you've learned a valuable lesson tonight, Mr. Osborne. I hope you've learned that you can't penetrate this army and get away with it. You think we're just a bunch of stupid tigs? A bunch of dumb micks from the bogs? The IRA has been fighting the British government for nearly 100 years on this island. We've picked up a thing or two about the intelligence business along the way. Michael drank his tea and remained silent. By the way, if it makes you feel any better, it was Buchanan who led us to Maguire, not you. The IRA has a special unit that follows volunteers suspected of treason. The unit is so secret I'm the only one who knows the identities of the members. I had Maguire followed in London last year, and we saw him meeting with Buchanan. That piece of news didn't make Michael feel any better. Why grab me? He said. Because I want to tell you something. Devlin leaned across the table with his dock worker's hands beneath his chin. The CIA and the British services are trying to track down the members of the Ulster Freedom Brigade. I think the IRA can be of help. After all, it's in our interest, too, that this violence be brought under control quickly. What do you have? A weapons cache in the Sperrin Mountains, Devlin said. It's not ours, and we don't think it belongs to one of the other Protestant paramilitaries. Where in the Sperrin Mountains? A farmhouse outside the village of Crana. Devlin handed Michael a slip of paper with a crudely drawn map showing the location of the farm. Michael said, what have you seen? Trucks coming and going, crates being unloaded, the usual. People? A couple of lads seem to live there full time. They patrol the fields around the house regularly. Well armed, I might add. Does the IRA still have the farm under watch? We pulled back. We don't have the equipment to do it right. Why give this to me? Why not give it to the British or the RUC? Because I don't trust them, and I never will. Remember, there are some elements within the RUC and British intelligence who have cooperated with the Protestant paramilitaries over the years. I want these Protestant bastards stopped before they drag us into a full-scale war again, and I don't trust the British and the RUC to do the job alone. Devlin crushed out his cigarette. He looked at Michael and smiled again. Now, was that worth a couple of cuts and scrapes? Fuck you, Devlin, Michael said. Devlin burst out laughing. You're free to go now. Put on your coat. I want to show you something before you leave. Michael followed Devlin through the house. The air smelled of frying bacon. Devlin led him through a sitting room into a kitchen with copper pots hanging above the stove. It might have been something out of an Irish country magazine, if not for the half-dozen men seated around the table, glaring at Michael through the slits in their balaclavas. You'll need this, Devlin said, taking a wool cap from the rack next to the door and placing it carefully on Michael's swollen scalp. A dirty night out, I'm afraid. Michael followed Devlin along a muddy footpath. It was so dark he might as well have been wearing the hood again. He could see the outline of Devlin's wrestler's physique in front of him, marching along the path, and he felt himself strangely drawn to him. When they reached the barn, Devlin hammered on the door and murmured something in Gaelic. Then he pulled open the door and led Michael inside. It took Michael a few seconds to realize that the man tied to the chair was Kevin Maguire. He was naked and shivering with cold and terror. He had been beaten savagely. His face was horribly distorted, and blood flowed from a dozen different cuts, above his eyes, on his cheeks, around his mouth. Both eyes were swollen shut. There were wounds on every part of his body, contusions, abrasions, lacerations from being whipped with a belt, burns from cigarettes being ground into his skin. He was sitting in his own excrement. Three men in balaclavas stood guard around him. "This is what we do to touts in the IRA, Mr. Osborne," Devlin said. "Remember this the next time you try to convince one of our men to betray the IRA and his people." McGuire said, "Michael, is that you?" Michael moved forward carefully, slipping between McGuire's tormentors and kneeling at his side. He knew there was nothing he could say, so he just wiped some of the blood from his eyes and laid a hand gently on his shoulder. "I'm sorry, Kevin," Michael said, his voice hoarse with emotion. "My God, I'm so sorry." "It's not your fault, Michael," McGuire whispered. He paused for a moment because the effort required to speak caused him more pain. "It's this place. I told you, nothing's going to change here. Nothing's ever going to change in this place." Devlin stepped forward and took Michael's arm, pulling him away. He walked Michael back outside. "That's the real world in there," Devlin said. "I didn't kill Kevin McGuire. You killed him." Michael spun and punched Devlin. The blow landed high on his left cheekbone and sent him sprawling into the mud. Devlin just laughed and rubbed his face. A pair of men came running out of the house. Devlin waved them away. "Not bad, Michael. Not bad at all." "Get him a priest," Michael said, breathing hard. "Let him have his last confession. Then put a bullet in him. He's suffered enough." "He'll get his priest," Devlin said, still rubbing his face. "And I'm afraid he'll get his bullet, too. But remember one thing. If you and your British mates don't stop the Ulster Freedom Brigade, this place will blow. If that happens, don't try to penetrate us, because the fucking tout will end up just like McGuire." They drove for a very long time. Michael tried to keep track of the turn so he might find the farm again, but after a while he just closed his eyes and tried to rest. Finally the car stopped. Someone hammered on the trunk and said, "Is your fucking hood on?" "Yes," Michael answered. He had no strength left for mental games, and he wanted to be away from them. Two men lifted him out and laid him in the wet grass bordering the roadway. A moment later they placed something next to him. "Leave the hood on until you can't hear the car engine anymore." Michael sat up as they drove off. He ripped away his hood, hoping to catch a glimpse of the identification number, but they had doused the lights. Then he turned to see what they had placed next to him, and found himself staring into the lifeless face of Kevin McGuire. XIX. London. "They obviously followed you to the meeting," Wheaton said, with the certainty of a man who never permitted the facts to get in the way of his theory, especially if it resolved things in his favor. "I engaged in a thorough SDR, totally by the book," Michael said. "I was clean. They followed McGuire to the meeting, not me. That's why he passed on the first two sites, because he suspected he was being watched. I only wish he'd had the good sense to trust his instincts. He'd still be alive." Michael was sitting at a table in the small private kitchen of Winfield House. It was early evening, nearly 24 hours since the IRA had snatched him from the streets of Belfast. They had dumped him outside the village of Dromara. Michael had had no choice but to leave McGuire's body by the roadside and get as far away as he could as quickly as possible. He had walked to Banbridge, a Protestant town southeast of Portadown, and flagged down a delivery truck. He told the driver he had been robbed and beaten and that his car had been stolen. The driver was bound for Belfast, but said he would be willing to take Michael to the RUC station in Banbridge to file a report. Michael said he would prefer to get back to his hotel in Belfast and file a report there. After arriving at the Europa in Belfast, Michael awakened Wheaton in London. Wheaton made the necessary calls to his British counterparts and arranged for an RAF helicopter to collect Michael from Aldergrove Airport. "You haven't been operational in the field for a long time, Michael," Wheaton said. "Maybe you missed something." "You're suggesting I got Kevin McGuire killed? You're the only case officer that was there." "I remember how to spot surveillance. I remember the parameters for making a meeting or passing on one. Devlin said they'd known McGuire was working for us for months." "Seamus Devlin is not exactly a source I trust." He knew Buchanan's name. McGuire probably gave it to him under torture. Michael knew it was impossible to win this argument. Jack Buchanan worked for London Station. He was one of Wheaton's men, and Wheaton would go to the mat to protect him. "Obviously, one of you fucked up, and fucked up badly," Wheaton said. "We've lost one of our most valuable assets. Our British cousins are in a tizzy, and you're lucky to be alive." "What about Devlin's information?" "It's all been passed on to headquarters and MI5, in accordance with our original arrangement on the McGuire matter. Obviously, we can't put a site under watch in Northern Ireland. The British will have to make that decision, and they need to weigh it against other operational priorities. Quite frankly, it's out of our hands at this point." "That information cost the life of my agent." "McGuire wasn't your agent. He was our agent, the British and ours. We ran him jointly and we shared in the take, remember? We're all upset he was blown. I don't want to lose an opportunity to crack the Ulster Freedom Brigade because we're jittery about the way we got the information." "You must admit the whole thing was a bit unorthodox. What if the information from Devlin is smoke?" "Why would the IRA do that?" "To murder a few British intelligence officers and SAS men. We give the information to the British put a team in place, and the IRA sneaks up on them in the middle of the night and slits their throats. The IRA is abiding by the ceasefire and the peace accords. They have no reason to set up the British." "I still don't trust them." "The information is good. We need to act on it quickly. It's a British matter, Michael, and therefore it's a British decision. If I try to lean on them, they won't like it, just as we wouldn't like it if the roles were reversed. So let me do it quietly." "Graham Seymour?" Michael nodded. Wheaton made a show of careful deliberation. "All right. Arrange a meeting with him tomorrow, then get the fuck out of here. I want you stateside." Wheaton paused a moment and examined Michael's face. "It's probably better that you stay here another day anyway. I wouldn't want your wife to see you like this." Michael went to bed early but couldn't sleep. Each time he closed his eyes, the whole thing played out inside his head. The beating in the back of the car, Devlin's Cheshire Cat smile, McGuire's dead eyes. He pictured his agent strapped to the chair, beaten beyond recognition, beaten until there was nothing left of his face. Twice he stumbled into the bathroom and was violently sick. He remembered Devlin's words. "I didn't kill Kevin McGuire. You killed him." His body ached every place they had hit him. No position was comfortable enough to sleep. Whenever he felt sorry for himself, he thought of McGuire and his miserable, humiliating death. Michael took pills for the pain, and finally pills to make him sleep. He dreamed about it all night, except in his dreams it was Michael who beat Kevin McGuire, and Michael who put a bullet in the back of his head. "That's some eye," Graham Seymour said the next morning. "Beautiful, isn't it?" Michael put his sunglasses back on, even though the skies were overcast. They were walking side by side along a footpath on Parliament Hill in Hampstead Heath. Michael needed to rest, so they sat down on a bench. To their left, Highgate Hill rose into the mist. In front of them, beyond the heath, spread central London. Michael could make out the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral in the distance. Children flew colorful kites around them as they spoke.
"I still can't believe you actually punched Seamus Devlin."
"Neither can I, but goddammit, it felt good."
"Do you know how many people would love to smack him one?"
"I suspect it would be a long line."
"A very long line, darling. Did it hurt?"
"Him or me?"
"You," Graham said, reflexively rubbing one long bony hand with the other.
"A little."
"I'm sorry about McGuire."
"He was a damn good agent." Michael lit a cigarette. The smoke grabbed at the back of his throat, and when he coughed, he clutched his broken ribs in pain. "What's the thinking inside Tam's house? Are you going to put the site under watch?"
"The top floor's a bit incredulous, to be honest," Graham said. "They're also quite miffed over the loss of McGuire."
"Wheaton thinks it's a trap, that the IRA wants to kill a few intelligence officers."
"Wheaton would think that. That's the way he'd do it." I think the information is good, Michael said. Devlin knew we would be skeptical. That's why he met face to face, to show us he was serious. You're probably right, Graham said. I'll try to push things along quietly from the inside. In fact, I may pop over to Ulster and handle it myself. I need a break from Helen. She's entered a new phase, retro-punk. She's spiked her hair, and she listens to nothing but the Clash and the Sex Pistols. This too shall pass, Michael pronounced solemnly. I know, but I'm just afraid the next one will be something worse. Michael laughed for the first time in many days. At Cannon Point, Elizabeth laid a pair of large quilts on the floor of the bedroom. She placed the children on the quilts, first Jake, then Liza, and surrounded them with stuffed animals, squeeze toys, and rattles. For 20 minutes she lay on the floor between them, playing and making the same silly cooing sounds that drove her mad before she had children. She sat down on the end of the bed and just watched them. She had forced herself to abandon her trial preparations and focus on nothing but the children for the entire weekend. It had been wonderful. That morning she had taken the children for a long walk along the shore road, then to lunch at her favorite restaurant in Sag Harbor. It would have been perfect except for the fact that her husband and her father were both in London. She marveled at how different the children were already. Liza was like her mother, outgoing, social, talkative in her own way, eager to please others. Jake was just the opposite. Jake lived in his head. Liza was already trying to tell everyone what she was thinking. Jake was private. He kept secrets. He's 4 months old, she thought, and he's already just like his father and his grandfather. If he becomes a spy, I think I'll shoot myself. Then she thought of the way she'd been treating Michael, and she immediately felt guilty. She had no right to resent Michael for accepting the Northern Ireland Task Force job. In fact, she had come to the conclusion that it had been foolish of her to allow him to leave the agency in the first place. He was right. It was an important job, and for some reason it seemed to make him happy. Elizabeth looked at the children. Liza was chattering at a tiny stuffed dog, but Jake lay on his back, gazing upward through the window, lost in his own secret world. Michael was what he was, and there was no use trying to change him. Once she had loved him for it. She thought of Michael in Belfast, and a chill ran over her. She wondered what he was doing, whether he had gone to dangerous places. She would never get used to the idea of his leaving home and going into the field. Such a silly term, she thought, the field, as if it were some sort of pleasant meadow where nothing bad ever happened. When he was away, she had a constant ball of anxiety in her abdomen. At night, she slept with a light burning and the television playing softly. It wasn't necessarily that she feared for his safety. She had seen Michael in action before, and she knew he could take care of himself. The anxiety came from the knowledge that Michael became a different man when he was away. When he came home, he always seemed a bit like a stranger. He lived a different life when he was in the field, and sometimes Elizabeth wondered whether she was a part of it. She saw headlights on the shore road. She went to the window and watched as a car stopped at the security gate. The guard waved the car into the compound without telephoning the house first, which meant the driver was Michael. Maggie, Elizabeth called. Maggie came into the room. Yes, Elizabeth. Michael's home. Can you watch the children for a minute?
Of course.
Elizabeth ran down the stairs. She grabbed a coat from the hook in the entrance hall and wrapped it around her shoulders as she hurried across the drive toward the car. She threw her arms around him and said, I've missed you, Michael. I'm so sorry about everything. Please forgive me. For what? He said, kissing her forehead softly. For being such a horse's ass. She squeezed him, and Michael groaned. She pushed him away, a puzzled look on her face, and pulled him into a patch of light leaking from a window.
Oh, my God! What happened to you?
20. London, Mykonos, Athens. 1 week after Michael Osborne's departure from London, a silver Jaguar slipped into the drive of the Georgian mansion in St. John's Wood. In the back seat sat the director. He was a small man, narrow of head and hips, with sandstone hair gone to gray and eyes the color of seawater in winter.
He lived alone with a boy from the Society for Protection and a girl called Daphne, who served as a receptionist and tended to his personal needs. His driver, a former member of the elite Special Air Service Commandos, climbed out and opened the rear door. Daphne stood outside the entranceway, shielded from the driving rain by a large black umbrella. She always looked as though she had just returned from a holiday in the tropics. She was 6 feet tall, with skin the color of caramel and brown hair streaked with blonde that fell about her throat and shoulders. She stepped forward and escorted the director into the entrance hall, carefully holding the umbrella aloft to make certain he remained perfectly dry. The director was prone to recurring bronchial infection. For him, the damp of the English winter was the equivalent of walking across a minefield without a grid. "Picasso is on the secure line from Washington," Daphne said. The director had spent thousands of pounds on speech therapy to eliminate the lilt of Jamaica from her accent. Now she had the voice of a BBC newsreader. "Will you take the call now, or shall I ring her back?" "Now is fine." He walked straight to his study, pressed the blinking green button on the telephone, and picked up the receiver. He listened for several minutes, murmured a few words, and listened again. "Everything all right, Petal?" Daphne asked after the director had replaced the receiver.
"We need to go to Mykonos in the morning," he said. "I'm afraid Monsieur Delaroche is in rather serious trouble."
It still felt very much like winter in London, but it was mild and sunny when the Island Air turboprop carrying the director and Daphne touched down on Mykonos early the following afternoon. They checked into a hotel in Kora and strolled along the waterfront in Little Venice until they found the café. Delaroche sat at a table overlooking the harbor. He wore khaki shorts and a sleeveless boater shirt. His fingers were red and black with paint. The director shook his hand as though he were searching for a pulse. Then he pulled the white cotton handkerchief from the breast pocket of his jacket and dabbed at his palm. "Any signs of the opposition?" the director asked mildly. Delaroche shook his head. "Why don't we adjourn to your villa?" the director said. "I do like what you've done with the place." Delaroche drove them in his battered Volvo station wagon to Cape Mavros. His canvases and easel rattled in the rear storage compartment. The director sat in the front seat, clutching the armrest, as Delaroche sped over the narrow, rolling road. Daphne lay sprawled over the back seat, the breeze from the open window tossing her hair. Delaroche served supper on the terrace. When they had finished, Daphne excused herself and lay on a chaise out of earshot.
"I commend you on your work in the Ahmed Hussein case," the director said, raising his glass of wine.
Delaroche did not return the gesture. He took no pleasure from the act of killing, only a sense of accomplishment from carrying out his assignment in a professional manner. Delaroche did not consider himself a murderer. He was an assassin. The men who ordered the killings were the real murderers. Delaroche was just the weapon.
"The contractors are quite pleased," the director said. His voice was as dry as dead leaves. "Hussein's death has provoked exactly the response they had hoped. It has, however, left us with a bit of a security issue where you are concerned."
The back of Delaroche's neck turned suddenly hot with a rush of anxiety. Throughout his career, he had obsessively guarded his personal security. Most people in his line of work regularly had plastic surgery to change their appearance. Delaroche dealt with it another way. Only a handful of people who knew what he really did for a living had ever seen his face. The only photographs made of him were the pictures in his false passports, and Delaroche had slightly altered his appearance in each one to make them useless to police and intelligence services. When he passed through airports or train terminals, he always wore a hat and sunglasses to hide his face from surveillance cameras. Still, he was aware of the fact that the CIA knew of his existence and had compiled a rather extensive dossier on his killings over the years.
"What kind of security issue?" Delaroche asked. "The CIA has issued an alert to Interpol and all friendly intelligence services. You've been placed on an international watch list. Every passport control officer and border policeman in Europe has one of these."
The director withdrew a folded piece of paper from the breast pocket of his jacket and handed it to Delaroche. Delaroche unfolded the paper and found himself staring at a composite sketch of his own face. It was remarkably lifelike. Obviously it had been produced by a sophisticated computer. I thought they believed I was dead.
So did I. But obviously they now assume you are very much alive.
The director paused to light a cigarette.
You didn't shoot Ahmed Hussein in the face, did you?
Delaroche shook his head slowly and tapped his forefinger against his chest. Delaroche had but one professional vanity. Over the years he had killed most of his victims with 3 gunshots to the face. He supposed he had done it because he had wanted his enemies to know he existed. Delaroche had only 2 things in his life, his art and his trade. He left his paintings unsigned for reasons of security, and those he sold were sold anonymously. He had chosen to leave a signature on his killings.
"Who's behind this?" Delaroche said.
"Your old friend, Michael Osborne."
"Osborne? I thought he retired."
"He was brought out of retirement recently to lead a special CIA task force on Northern Ireland. It seems Osborne has some expertise in that area as well."
Delaroche handed the composite back to the director. "What do you have in mind?"
"It seems to me we have 2 options. If we do nothing, I'm afraid your ability to work has been seriously diminished. If you cannot travel, you cannot work. And if your face is known to policemen around the world, you cannot travel."
"Option number 2?
"We give you a new face and a new place to live."
Delaroche looked out at the sea. He knew he had no choice but to endure plastic surgery and change his appearance. If he could not work, the director would terminate their relationship. He would lose the protection of the society and lose the ability to earn a living. He would have to spend the rest of his life looking over his shoulder, wondering which day his enemies would come for him. Delaroche, more than anything, wanted security, and that meant accepting the director's offer.
"You have someone who can do the work?"
"A Frenchman named Maurice Leroux."
"Is he trustworthy?"
"Absolutely," the director said. "You can't leave Greece until the surgery is done. Therefore, Leroux will have to come here. I'll rent a flat in Athens where he can do the work. You can recuperate there until the scars have healed."
"What about the villa?"
"I'll keep it for the time being. I need a venue for the spring meeting of the Executive Council. This will do nicely."
Delaroche looked around him. The isolated house on the north side of Mykonos had given him everything he needed: privacy, security, excellent subjects for his work, challenging terrain for his cycling. He did not want to leave it, just as he had not wanted to leave his last home, on the Breton coast in France. But there was no choice.
"We'll need to find you a new place to live," the director said. "Do you have a preference?"
Delaroche thought for a moment.
"Amsterdam."
"Do you speak Dutch?"
"Not much, but it won't take long."
"Very well," the director said. "Amsterdam it is."
Stavros, the real estate agent, arranged for a caretaker. Delaroche told him he would be away for a long time, but that a friend might use the villa from time to time. Stavros offered to take Delaroche to the taverna for a farewell meal. Delaroche politely declined. He spent his last day on Mykonos painting. The square in Anomera, the terrace of his villa, the rocks at Linos. He worked from first light until dusk, until his right hand, the hand that had been wounded, began to ache. He sat on the terrace and drank wine until the setting sun painted his whitewashed villa a shade of raw sienna that Delaroche could never hope to duplicate on canvas. He went inside and set several logs ablaze in the fireplace. Then he went through the villa, room by room, cabinet by cabinet, drawer by drawer, and burned anything that suggested he ever had existed.
"It's a shame we have to spoil such a beautiful face," Maurice Leroux said the following day.
They were seated before a large, harshly lit mirror in the Athens flat the director had rented for Delaroche's surgery and recovery. LaRue gently probed Delaroche's cheekbone with the tip of his thin forefinger. "You're not French," he pronounced solemnly, as though he believed this might be hard news for a fellow Frenchman to take. "One learns a great deal about ethnicity and ancestry in this line of work. I'd say you're a Slav of some sort, perhaps even a Russian." Delaroche said nothing while LaRue continued on with his lecture. "I can see it here, in the broad cheekbones, in the flat forehead, and in the angular jawline. And look here, look at your eyes. They're virtually almond-shaped, and brilliant blue. No, you may have a French name, but I'm afraid there is Slavic blood coursing through your veins. Very fine Slavic blood, however." Delaroche looked at LaRue's reflection in the mirror. He was a weak man with large nose, a receding chin, and a ridiculous hairpiece that was far too black. LaRue was touching Delaroche's face again. He had the hands of an old woman, pale, soft, shot with thick blue veins, but they stank of a young man's cologne. "Sometimes it's possible to make a man more attractive through plastic surgery. I worked on a Palestinian a few years ago, a man called Muhammad Awad." Delaroche flinched at the mention of Awad's name. LaRue had committed the ultimate sin for a man in his line of work, revealing the identity of a previous client. "He's dead now, but he was quite beautiful when I'd finished with him," LaRue continued. "In your case, I think the reverse is going to be true. I'm afraid we're going to be forced to make you less attractive in order to alter your appearance. Are you at peace with that prospect, monsieur?" LaRue was an ugly man to whom appearances mattered a great deal. Delaroche was an attractive man to whom appearances mattered very little. He knew some women found him attractive, beautiful in some cases, but he had never cared much how he looked. He was concerned with only one thing. His face had become a threat to him, and he would deal with it the way he dealt with all threats, by eliminating it. "Do what you have to do," Delaroche said. "Very well," LaRue replied. "You have a face of angles and sharp edges. Those angles will be turned into curves, and the edges dulled. I intend to shave a portion of your cheekbones to make them smoother and rounder. I'll inject collagen into the tissue of your cheeks to make your face heavier. You have a very thin chin. I'll make it squarer and thicker. Your nose is a masterpiece, but I'm afraid it must go. I'll flatten it and make it wider between the eyes. As for the eyes, there's nothing I can do except change their color with contact lenses." "Will it work?" Delaroche asked. "When I'm finished, even you won't recognize your face." He hesitated. "Are you sure you want to go through with this?" Delaroche nodded. "Very well," LaRue said. "But I feel a bit like that idiot who took a hammer to the Pietà." He removed a pen from his pocket and began making marks on Delaroche's face. 21. London. Preston McDaniels was a career Foreign Service officer attached to the Public Affairs section of the American Embassy in London. He was 45, trim, and presentable if not conventionally attractive. He was also a lifelong bachelor, who had dated few women, which had led to persistent speculation among colleagues that he was homosexual. Preston McDaniels was not a homosexual. He simply had never had a way with women. Until recently. It was 6 o'clock in the evening, and McDaniels was packing away his things and tidying up his small office. He stood in his window and looked out on Grosvenor Square. He had fought hard to get to London after years of brutal postings in places like Lagos, Mexico City, Cairo, and Islamabad. He had never been happier. He loved the theater, the museums, the shopping, the interesting places to go on weekends. He had a smart flat in South Kensington and came to work each morning by tube. His job was still rather dull. He issued routine press releases, prepared daily summaries from the British press on issues of interest to the ambassador, and coordinated press coverage of the ambassador's public events. But living in London made it all seem somehow exciting. He grabbed a stack of files from his desk and placed them in his leather briefcase. He removed his Macintosh from the hook behind the door and went out. He stopped in the bathroom and looked himself over in the mirror. Sometimes he wondered what she saw in him. He tried to arrange his hair to conceal the bald spot, but only managed to make things worse. She said she liked balding men, said they looked smarter, more mature. "She's too young for me," he thought. "Too young and far too pretty." But he couldn't help himself. For the first time in his life, he was in an exciting sexual relationship. He couldn't stop now. Outside, it was raining and darkness had fallen on Grosvenor Square. He put up an umbrella against the rain and picked his way along the crowded pavements to the park lane. He stood outside the restaurant and watched her through the window for a moment. She was tall and fit, with rich black hair, an oval face, and gray eyes. Her white blouse could not conceal her large, rounded breasts. She was a wonderful lover. She seemed to know his every fantasy. Each afternoon at work, he stared at the clock, anticipating the moment he could see her again. McDaniels went inside the restaurant and sat down at a table in the bar. When she spotted him, she winked and mouthed the words, "I'll be there in a minute." She brought him a glass of white wine a moment later. He touched her hand as she placed the glass on the table. "I've missed you terribly, darling." "I thought you'd never come," she said. "But I can't talk now. Ricardo's having a complete psychotic episode tonight. If he sees me talking to you, he'll sack me." "You're just being friendly to a regular customer." She smiled seductively and said, "Very friendly." "I need to see you. I'm off at 10. I can't wait that long." "I'm afraid you have no choice." She winked and walked away. McDaniels drank his wine and watched her as she moved from table to table, taking orders, delivering food, and interacting with the customers. She was the kind of woman that men noticed. She was too attractive and too talented to be waiting tables. He knew she would find her own place in the world eventually, and then she would leave him. McDaniels finished his wine, left a 10-pound note on the table, and went out. He realized it was too much money for a single glass of wine. "She'll get the idea I think she's a whore," he thought. He considered going back inside and leaving less money, but he knew that would look even more peculiar. McDaniels walked away, thinking that if she ever left him, he might very well kill himself. McDaniels took his time going home. The rain eased up, so he walked, enjoying the city and the floating sensation from the wine and spending even a few minutes with Rachel. He had never felt anything like obsession before, but he knew it must feel something like this. It was beginning to affect his work. He was drifting off in meetings, losing his train of thought in mid-sentence. People were beginning to talk, to ask questions. He didn't care, really. He had lived without the love of a woman his entire life. He was going to enjoy the sensation while it lasted. He ate supper in a pub off the Brompton Road. He read the newspapers, and for a few minutes Rachel managed not to intrude on his thoughts. But after a while she was there again, like a pleasant piece of music running round his head. He imagined her in bed, her mouth open in pleasure, her eyes closed. Then the silly fantasies took over, the wedding ceremony in an English country church, the village in the Cotswolds, the children. It was a ludicrous image, but he enjoyed the idea of it. He had fallen hopelessly in love. But Rachel didn't seem like the marrying kind. She wanted to write. She cherished her freedom, her intellectual freedom and her sexual freedom. The first time he mentioned marriage, she would probably run as fast as she could. McDaniels drifted through the quiet side streets of South Kensington. He had a pleasant two-bedroom flat on the first floor of a Georgian terraced house. He let himself in and flipped through the afternoon post. He took a long shower and changed into a pair of khaki trousers and a cotton pullover. He used the spare bedroom as a study. He watched the 9 o'clock news while he worked his way through a stack of papers from the office. Ambassador Cannon had a busy day tomorrow. A meeting with the foreign secretary, a luncheon with a group of British business leaders, an interview with a reporter from the Times. When he finished, he placed his papers in a manila file folder and placed the folder back in his briefcase. Shortly before 10:30, the building's intercom buzzed softly. McDaniels pressed the button and said playfully, "Who's there?" "It's me, darling," she said. "We're expecting one of your other lovers." It was a little game they played, jokes about other lovers, feigned jealousy. It was amazing how quickly their relationship had progressed. "You're the only woman I've ever had in my entire life." "Liar." "Hang up and I'll buzz you in." He smoothed his hair while he waited for her to arrive. He heard footsteps outside in the hall, but he didn't want to appear over-eager to see her, so he waited for her to knock. When he pulled back the door, she stepped into his arms and kissed him on the mouth. Her lips parted and her silken tongue slid over his. She pulled away slightly and said, "I've been waiting to do that all night." Preston McDaniels smiled. "How did I get so lucky to find someone like you?"
"I'm the lucky one. Can I get you something to drink?" "Actually, I have a very serious problem, and you're the only one who can help me."
She took his hand and led him to the bedroom, unbuttoning her blouse as she moved. She pushed him down on the end of the bed and pulled his face to her breasts.
"Oh, my God," he groaned. "Hurry, darling," she said. "Please, hurry."
Rebecca Wells awakened at 3 o'clock in the morning. She lay very still for several minutes, listening to McDaniel's breathing. He was a heavy sleeper, naturally, and he had made love to her twice tonight. She sat up, eased her way out of bed, and crossed the floor. Her blouse lay on the floor where she had left it. She scooped it up, let herself out, and softly closed the door. She pulled on the blouse as she crossed the hall and entered his study. She closed that door, too, and sat down at the desk. The briefcase was on the floor, unlocked. She opened it and picked through the contents until she found what she was looking for. A folder containing details of Ambassador Douglas Cannon's schedule for the following day. She took a notepad from his desk and began scribbling furiously. It was all there, the time of each meeting, the method of transportation, the route. She finished copying the schedule and quickly flipped through the rest of the papers to see if there was anything interesting. When she was done, she returned the file to its place in the briefcase and switched off the light. She slipped into the hallway and entered the bathroom. She closed the door and turned on the light. She threw water on her face and stared at her reflection in the mirror. She had made a promise to herself when the IRA killed Ronnie. She would never marry, and she would never take another man to their bed. She had thought it was going to be a difficult vow to keep, but the hatred that filled her heart after his death left no room for any other emotion, especially love for another man. A few men from Portadown had tried to pursue her, but she had pushed them all away. Inside the brigade, the men knew better than to waste their time. She thought of Preston McDaniels inside her body and wanted to vomit. She told herself it was for an important cause, the future of the Protestant way of life in Northern Ireland. In a way, she almost felt sorry for McDaniels. He was a decent man, kind and gentle, but he had fallen for the oldest trick in the book, the honey trap. Tonight he had said he was in love with her. She dreaded what would happen to him when inevitably he learned that she had betrayed him. She drank a glass of water and flushed the toilet. Then she shut off the light and slipped back into bed. "I thought you'd never come back," McDaniel said softly. She nearly screamed, but she managed to keep her composure.
"I was just a little thirsty."
"Bring any for me?"
"Sorry, darling."
"Actually, there's something else I want." He rolled on top of her. "You," he said.
"Can you?"
He pulled her hand to his groin.
"Well, well," she said. "We should do something about that."
He thrust deeply into her body. Rebecca Wells closed her eyes and thought of her dead husband. County Tyrone, Northern Ireland. Shortly after Northern Ireland exploded into violence in 1969, British intelligence decided that the best way to combat terrorism was to track the movements of individual terrorists. Known members of paramilitary organizations are routinely followed and monitored by British intelligence and by E4, the Special Surveillance Unit of the Royal Ulster Constabulary. Sightings and movements are fed into a computer at Army Intelligence Headquarters in Belfast. If a terrorist suddenly vanishes from a watch list, the computer automatically raises a red flag. The security forces assume he is probably involved in an operation. Surveillance of such magnitude requires thousands of officers and advanced technology. Trouble spots like the Falls Road in Belfast are covered by a multitude of video cameras. The Army maintains a post atop the towering Divis Flats. During the day, soldiers scan the streets with high-powered binoculars, looking for known members of the IRA. At night, they search with infrared night vision glasses. The security services place tracking devices in cars. They place listening devices and miniature video cameras in homes, pubs, automobiles, and hay sheds. They monitor telephones. They have even planted bugs in individual weapons to track their movements throughout the province. Sophisticated intelligence aircraft patrol the skies, looking for human activity at night where there should be none. Small pilotless drones perform low-level reconnaissance. Sensors are hidden in trees to detect human movement. But despite all the high-tech equipment, much of the monitoring must be done the old-fashioned way, with man-on-man surveillance. It is dangerous work, sometimes deadly. Undercover officers routinely patrol the Falls Road area of Belfast. They hide in attics and on rooftops for days on subsistence rations, photographing their quarry. In the countryside, they hide in holes behind bushes atop trees. In the lexicon of Northern Ireland intelligence, this practice is known as digging in. It was the method chosen to monitor the tumble-down farmhouse outside the village of Crana in the Sperrin Mountains. Graham Seymour arrived from London on the sixth day of the operation. For their static post, they had chosen a clump of gorse surrounded by a stand of tall beech trees on a hillside about a half mile from the house. A pair of E4 officers handled the technical equipment, long lens and infrared cameras, long-range directional microphones. They worked as quietly as altar boys, and looked as young. They playfully introduced themselves as Marks and Sparks. Over the years, the IRA had ambushed and killed dozens of intelligence officers on surveillance. Even though the targets were suspected loyalists, they took no chances. Two commandos from the elite Special Air Service, the SAS, formed a protective perimeter around Graham and Marks and Sparks. They wore camouflage gear and blacked out their faces with grease paint. Twice, Graham nearly tripped over them while relieving himself in the gorse. He longed for a cigarette, but smoking wasn't allowed. After 3 days of eating nothing but special high-calorie sludge, he was desperate for even Helen's appalling cooking. At night, sleeping on the damp, freezing hillside, he silently cursed Michael Osborne's name. It was clear something wasn't right about the farmhouse in the small glen below them. A pair of brothers called Dalton owned it. They tended a small flock of scrawny sheep and a few dozen chickens. Each day, once in the morning and again at dusk, they slowly walked the edge of their land, as if looking for signs of trouble. They received their first visitor on the tenth night. He arrived in a small Nissan sedan. Marks and Sparks fired away rapidly with their infrared cameras, while Graham peered down toward the farmhouse through night vision binoculars. He saw a tall, powerfully built man with a head of unruly hair carrying a tennis bag over his right shoulder. "What do you think?" Graham asked no one in particular. "He's trying to make it look light," Marks said, "but the shoulder strap is straining." "He's definitely not carrying rackets and balls in that thing," said Sparks. Graham picked up a small radio and contacted the RUC station in Cookstown, 15 miles to the southeast. "We have company. Stand by for further instructions." The visitor remained inside the farmhouse for 20 minutes. Marks and Sparks tried to eavesdrop on the activity inside the house, but all they could hear was Bach blaring from a tinny hi-fi.
"You recognize the piece?"
Marks asked.
"Concerto No. 5 in D major," Sparks said. "Lovely, isn't it?"
"Quite."
Graham was peering into the glen through infrared binoculars.
"He's leaving," he said.
"Short stay for this time of night," Marks said.
"Maybe he had to relieve himself," Sparks said.
"I'd say he probably relieved himself of a few weapons," Marks said. "That bag looks a bit lighter now, don't you think?"
Graham picked up the radio again and raised Cookstown. "The subject is heading east toward Mount Hamilton. Make it look like a routine stop. Plant a report on the radio of a security alert in the area. Send a few good guys through there so he doesn't feel like we're singling him out. I'll be down in a few minutes."
The man in the Nissan sedan was Gavin Spencer, the operations chief of the Ulster Freedom Brigade, and the tennis bag, now empty and lying on the seat next to him, had contained a shipment of Israeli-made Uzi machine guns from an arms dealer in the Middle East. The weapons were to be used for the assassination of Ambassador Douglas Cannon. For now, they were hidden inside a stone wall in the cellar of the farmhouse. Gavin Spencer had selected his team and briefed them on their mission. Rebecca Wells had gained access to the ambassador's schedule in London and was filing regular reports. All they needed now was the right moment, the moment when Cannon was most vulnerable. They would get only one chance. If they made a mistake, if they failed, the British and the Americans would tighten security even further, and they would never be able to get close to him again. Spencer sped along the winding B-47 through the darkened village of Mount Hamilton and then back onto the open roadway. A wave of relief passed over him. The weapons were out of his car and safely inside the walls of the farmhouse. If they had been discovered in his possession, he would have been given a one-way ticket to the maze. He pressed the accelerator and the Nissan responded, rising and falling over the rolling roadway. He switched on the radio, hoping to find some music, but a news bulletin on Ulster Radio caught his attention. A security alert had been declared in the Sperrin Mountains between Omagh and Cookstown. 3 miles later, he spotted the blue flashing lights of an RUC patrol car and the bulky outline of 2 Army troop carriers. An RUC officer stood in the middle of the road, waving his flashlight for Spencer to pull to the side. Spencer stopped and rolled down his window.
"Security alert in the area tonight, sir," the RUC man said. "Mind if I ask where you're heading tonight?"
"Home to Portadown," Spencer said.
"What brings you up here?"
"Visiting a friend."
"Where's the friend?"
"Crana."
"May I see your driver's permit, sir?"
Spencer handed it over. A second car braked to a halt behind him. Spencer could hear another officer asking the driver the same questions he had been asked. The RUC man looked over the permit and handed it back to Spencer.
"All right, sir," he said. "We're just going to have a look inside your car. Mind stepping out, sir?"
Spencer got out. The RUC man climbed in and pulled the car behind the troop carriers. A moment later, the second car disappeared behind the troop trucks. The motorist was a squat, powerfully built man with short-cropped hair and a graying mustache. He stood next to Spencer with his hands in the pockets of his leather jacket.
"What the fuck's this all about?" he said.
"They said it's a security alert."
"Fucking IRA, no doubt."
"Suppose so," Spencer said.
The man lit a cigarette and gave one to Spencer. It started to rain. Gavin Spencer smoked and tried to appear as calm as possible while the RUC and the Army tore apart his car. Graham Seymour stood behind the Army truck while a team of soldiers and police officers searched the Nissan. They used a portable imager to peer beneath the seat covers for hidden weapons. They tested for residue from explosives. They searched beneath the undercarriage and beneath the hood. They unscrewed the door panels and looked beneath the carpeting. They opened the trunk and picked through the contents. After 10 minutes, one of the RUC men gestured silently for Seymour to come over. Inside the spare tire, wrapped in a greasy rag, they had discovered a few suspicious-looking papers. Graham borrowed the officer's flashlight and shone it on the papers.
He flipped through them quickly, committing as many of the details as he could to memory, and handed them back to the officer.
"Place them where you found them," he said. "Exactly the way you found them."
The RUC man nodded and did as he was told.
"Hide a tracking beacon in the car and let him go," Graham said. "And then get me back to Belfast as fast as you fucking can. We've got a rather serious problem, I'm afraid."
23. New York, Portadown. It was 7 o'clock in the evening when Michael Osborne stepped outside the CIA's New York station in the World Trade Center and flagged down a taxi. It had been nearly 2 weeks since his return from London, and he was beginning to settle comfortably into the routine of his new life inside the agency. He usually worked 3 days a week in Washington and 2 in New York. Counterintelligence was wrapping up its inquiry into the death of Kevin Maguire, and Michael was confident his version of events would be accepted. Maguire was under suspicion by the IRA before Michael's trip to Belfast, and his death, while unfortunate, was not Michael's fault. The taxi crawled uptown through snarled traffic. Michael thought of Northern Ireland, of the dim lights of Belfast below the Black Mountain, of Kevin Maguire's broken body strapped to a chair. He rolled down the window and felt the cold air on his face. Sometimes he went a few minutes without thinking of Maguire, but at night, or when he was alone, Maguire's ravaged face always intruded. Michael was anxious for the information Maguire and Devlin had given him to bear fruit. If the Ulster Freedom Brigade was destroyed, Maguire's death would not be meaningless. The taxi driver was an Arab with the untrimmed beard of a devout Muslim. Michael gave him an address on Madison Avenue, 5 blocks from the apartment. He paid off the taxi and walked the crowded sidewalks, stopping to gaze into store windows, checking his tail constantly. It was the nagging fear that one day an old enemy would appear and take his revenge. He thought of his father searching his car for bombs, tearing apart telephones, and checking his tail for physical surveillance until the day he died. The secrecy was like a disease, the anxiety like an old and trusted friend. Michael was resigned to the fact it would never leave him. The assassin called October had seen to that. He walked west to Fifth Avenue, then turned right and headed uptown. The business of intelligence required remarkable patience, but Michael was beginning to grow restless when it came to October. Each morning he scanned the cables, hoping to catch some glimpse of him on a watch list, a sighting in an airport or a train terminal, but nothing had appeared. As more time elapsed, the trail would grow colder. Michael entered his building and took the elevator up to the apartment. Elizabeth was already home. She kissed his cheek and handed him a glass of white wine.
"Your face is beginning to look almost normal again," she said.
"Is that a good thing or a bad thing?" She kissed his mouth.
"Definitely a good thing. How are you feeling?"
He looked at her quizzically. "What the hell's gotten into you?"
"Nothing, sweetheart. I'm just happy to see you."
"It's good to see you, too. How was your day?"
"Not bad," she said. "I spent the day preparing my main witness for testifying in court."
"Is he going to hold up?"
"Actually, I'm afraid he's going to get killed under cross."
"Are the children still awake?"
"They're going down now. I want to see them." "Michael, if you wake them up, so help me God."
Michael walked into the nursery and leaned over the cribs. The children slept end to end, head to head, so they could see each other through the slats. He stood there for a long time, listening to them breathing softly. For a few minutes he felt peace, a sense of contentment he had not known in a long time. Then the anxiety crept up on him again, the fear that his enemies might harm him or his children. He heard the telephone ringing. He kissed each of them and went out. In the living room, Elizabeth held out the telephone to him.
"It's Adrian," she said.
Michael took the phone from her hand. "Yeah?" He listened for a few minutes without speaking, then murmured, "Jesus Christ." He hung up the telephone.
"What's wrong?"
Elizabeth said. I have to go to London.
When?
Michael checked his watch. I can make a flight tonight if I hurry. Elizabeth looked carefully at him.
Michael, I've never seen you like this before. What's wrong?
Early the next morning, as the British Airways jet carrying Michael Osborne neared Heathrow Airport, Kyle Blake and Gavin Spencer walked side by side along the Market High Street of Portadown. The sky was turning gray-blue in the east with the coming dawn. Street lamps still burned. The air smelled of farmland and baking bread. Spencer moved with the long, loose-limbed walk of a man with few cares, which was not the case that morning. Kyle Blake, a head shorter and several inches narrower, had the economy of movement of a battery-powered toy. Spencer spoke for a long time, constantly pushing his forelock of thick black hair from his forehead. Blake listened intensely, lighting one cigarette after the next.
"Maybe your eyes are playing tricks on you," Kyle Blake said when he finally spoke. "Maybe they were telling you the truth. Maybe it was just a routine security alert."
"They gave the car a thorough going over," Spencer said, "and they took their fucking time about it."
"Anything missing?" Spencer shook his head. "Anything there that shouldn't be there?"
"I searched the fucking thing from end to end. I didn't find anything, but that doesn't mean much. Those bugs are so small they could put one in my pocket and I wouldn't know it."
Kyle walked in silence for a moment. Gavin Spencer was a smart man and a gifted operations chief. He was not the kind to see a threat that wasn't there.
"If you're right, if they were after you, that means they're watching the farmhouse."
"Aye," Spencer said, "and I just hid the first shipment of Uzis there. I need those guns to do the job on the ambassador. I can kill Eamon Dillon with a handgun, but if I'm going to assassinate an American ambassador, I need considerably more firepower."
"What's the status of the team?"
"The last man leaves for England tonight on the Liverpool ferry. By tomorrow morning I'll have four of my best lads in London, waiting for the order to strike. But I need those guns, Kyle."
"So? We'll get the guns."
"But the farmhouse is under watch."
"So we'll take out the watchers," Blake said.
"Those men are probably protected by the SAS. I don't know about you, but I'm not in the mood to tango with the fucking SAS right now."
"We know they're out there somewhere. All we need to do is find them."
Blake stopped walking and fixed a hard stare on Spencer.
"Besides, if the bloody IRA can take on the SAS, so can we."
"They're British soldiers, Kyle. We were British soldiers once, remember?"
"We're not on the same side anymore," Blake said harshly. "If the British want to play games, we'll play fucking games."
This ends Disc 5.